Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Welcome to Street Psychology Podcast. Today I have my guest, Maddie Andrews, who's just going to be sharing a little bit about her story and her journey with mental health. So, Maddie, do you want to start by just introducing yourself?
Yes, thank you for having me. My name is Maddie. I'm an MSW student, mental health advocate, peer support specialist, and also someone living with serious mental illness.
You're in school right now to be a social worker. How's that going for you?
I love my program. I love social work. I love school. I love learning. It's a great opportunity. I'm very privileged to be able to access this type of education.
Yeah, it's a really rewarding career, and it takes a special person to invest in that career and to want to do that to help other people.
It's the beauty of social work, right, is that it teaches you to look at the whole person. Yes, I love to learn about mental illness and mental health, but people are comprised of so many things, and that's the beauty of social work.
You're talking about the trauma that we experience in life. So many people experience trauma, and your thing is how to turn that trauma into motivation. Can you speak more about that?
My first traumatic experience happened when I was 4 years old. I was actually sexually assaulted when I was four. And I told my teacher, and she was like, this is your fault. If you tell your parents, you're going to be in a whole lot of trouble. So I really developed PTSD at 4 years old. And then fast forward to middle school, I started developing things like hallucinations, delusions, paranoia, depression, mania. And a child only knows what they know. So I thought everybody had delusions and everybody had paranoia and this type of thing. So I didn't disclose. It wasn't until I was 14 that I started to disclose, but the evolution journey of my diagnosis process was long. It wasn't finalized until I was in my 30s. My final diagnosis is schizoaffective bipolar type, PTSD, OCD, and generalized anxiety. And living with such exacerbated symptoms was traumatic in itself. In my 20s, I was a teacher and didn't disclose to anybody because of stigma. And it really left me battling in silence. Fast forward to my 30s, I was on 10 to 15 mental health meds. I was extremely suicidal. I was self-harming. I had constant hallucinations and delusions. And my doctor called one day and she said, hey, there's a new medication out. And at this period of my life, I wasn't processing emotions. I wasn't feeling motivated. I was 420 pounds, losing my hair, no thyroid, all side effects of the medication. But when I started this new medication, I began to process emotions. I began to feel motivated and I began to feel my life again. And I did so well that she reduced my other medications. But when you live with bipolar type, you have to treat mania, depression, and psychosis. And unfortunately, she reduced my mania medication and I became manic. And for me, when I become severely manic, I also become severely psychotic. So I spent a few months like that until I put my foot down and I said, this is unsafe. I need to go out of work. I need some help. And I spent about a month bedridden. My husband was also written out of work to care for me. And I wasn't living life at all. And then in December of that year, she put up a medication called lithium. And for those who don't know, lithium is a heavy metal used to treat bipolar disorder. But when you get lithium treatment, part of that is checking your blood levels, checking the amount of lithium in your blood, checking your kidneys, checking your liver. And my doctor didn't do this. And pretty quickly, I was losing the ability to swallow, talk, walk, read, write, use a cell phone. I couldn't do anything. I didn't know what a toilet was. So eventually, after a few weeks like this, My husband took me to the hospital and it was discovered that I had extreme lithium toxicity and was dying. And it took 2 weeks in the ICU. Initially, they gave me fluids. That's the first course of treatment for lithium toxicity. But I was so resistant to this and they were continuing so many fluids, which is what you're supposed to do, that it enlarged my heart and it began to fail. And when your heart is failing and they're pushing fluids, it travels into your lungs. So the bottom half of both of my lungs collapsed and the lithium still wasn't gone. So I ended up with 2 rounds of dialysis to get the lithium clear. But at this point, the problem was I was still pretty unresponsive. So they did an EEG, which showed my brain activity was extremely low. And my husband and the doctors were trying to figure out if I had silent syndrome, if I would ever recover at all, if I was going to die, until my last day and I woke up. I couldn't talk very well. I couldn't walk very well. I couldn't use a toilet very well, but I woke up and was eventually transferred to the mental hospital. And this is where hope really arose for me. I had pen and paper and I practiced writing my name. I couldn't write at all at this point. And you can't have cell phones there, but somebody was nice enough to write down phone numbers for me. So when you have a brain injury, reading and inputting is very difficult. So I would read my little piece of paper and try to input it into the landline. And when I started to be able to do that, I got on the phone and I practiced talking and really began rehabbing myself. And when I got home, I spent the first couple of weeks feeling like I was dying. I had no idea what I had been through. I had amnesia. But when I read my medical records, this fire burned in my belly. And I said, I spent so many years of my life feeling like death was the only option. And here I am cheating death. Like, this is my opportunity to change my life, to overcome this traumatic experience, and to not only better my life, but the lives of other people. And I really absorbed and put myself into the world of coping skills. And I think the most important thing I did was I opened my mouth. I began talking. I was shamed about my diagnosis for so many years. But now I think I wear it like a badge of honor. You know what I mean? Like, it's a superpower to me. I can do all of these things in my life while battling mental illness.
You are very strong and unique, and not everyone who goes through a similar experience emerges with that same mindset.
And it wasn't an overnight thing for me. So the first couple of weeks of coming home, I just begged to die. I said, I couldn't even sit up. I had no idea what had happened. But one of the places I found to help me was a day treatment program. It's a therapeutic farm. And the most impactful word someone has ever said to me was someone who worked there. And he said, after an experience like this, you're never the same. Because I was chasing the old me. I just wanted to go back. But he said, this is the opportunity for you to create the you want to be and create the life you really want. And I just sobbed and I was like, you mean I can do anything I want and recover? Because they weren't sure if I would recover all my skills at this point. And I hold that really close to my heart today.
Even in that moment, someone telling you that for maybe the first time in your life, it wasn't easy for you to digest and let that in, was it?
No, I just sobbed because I wasn't happy with my life before. I really wasn't living to the full capacity. But when that's all you know, that's all you know. And I was so busy saying, I need to get back to the old me. And it took some time, but I began making baby steps. Okay, maybe I can do this and this. And when I excelled at that, I tried 3 more things. And when I was met with warmth and compassion, when I started speaking, warmth and compassion for my new ideas, it really motivated me to make bigger changes.
Positive self-talk, yeah. And retraining your brain.
I still do that today. With my schizophrenia symptoms, I have a lot of negative delusions in my own mind. And it's hard for me during the stressful moments to not ruminate on those. But I try to remember the love I hear from the outside world and the compassion and the grace, and let that sink into my pores, because I need to just discount the negativity in my own mind. And like you said, reframe that positive self-talk.
Yeah. And living with a severe mental illness, as we're talking about, that's even more difficult to get through these challenging moments in life and to believe in yourself and to believe that things could be better. But you've mastered that, accepting yourself exactly as you are and making the most of it.
It took me a long time to get there. And I can't lie, recovery isn't a linear process, and I'm going to have bad days. And my bad days just happen to come with self-doubt because of the delusions. And I have to read my journal or talk to a friend or talk to my husband and hear the positivity and allow myself to absorb it. When I'm extremely anxious or extremely psychotic, I get stuck in the negative. I know that about myself, but I also tell myself every single day that things will get better, things can get better. And I try to have a lot of encouraging words. Like, I start every day with a positive intention for the day. And I try to find the silver lining in a lot of things, because it really could be a lot worse. I could have died with that lithium toxicity.
Absolutely. Going back to something that you said earlier about childhood, you remember distinctly that your struggle started even before you knew it during childhood.
I had no idea. I stopped sleeping. I was a really great sleeper before this. I had panic attacks. I had attachment disorder to my parents. And my parents didn't know what to think. They had no idea this had happened to me. I was walking at an early age with some form of mental illness, but the first time I ever mentioned it to anybody was when I was 14, and that was only the compulsive thinking aspect. And then at 19, based on observations and being hospitalized for the first time, it changed to bipolar 1 disorder. Unbeknownst to me, it changed in my 20s to schizoaffective bipolar type. I didn't find out until my 30s. It was an evolution process, and every time you get a new diagnosis, it's a grieving process. I read my journal from when I found out I got diagnosed with schizoaffective, and I was sad. I said, I thought one thing about myself my entire life, and what does this mean? Can I not do what I want to do? I didn't know what schizoaffective was, and I didn't know anybody else with it. It was an extremely lonely process, and part of my recovery journey was making sure no one else feels alone. So I actually started a nonprofit in 2024, and one of our initiatives is free support groups to the community. And we have a free group, virtual, for people with schizoaffective disorder. And my goal with this is to make sure we have a community of like-minded people so we don't have to feel alone in this world.
Because loneliness is one of the most debilitating mental conditions out there. Right. And there's stigma around that. If you tell someone, I have this disorder or that disorder, you're immediately placed into a box.
That is so true. I didn't tell anybody for most of my life about my diagnosis because of the stigma. Today, I'm an extremely transparent person. Obviously, I'm doing this podcast. But even with my job, I tell my supervisor, because there may be a day when I'm having a bad day and need an accommodation. Sometimes I'm cautious about who I tell, because not everybody meets me with open arms. Some people don't understand mental illness, and they may project their own beliefs about that onto me, or people have told me harsh words because of it. But I try to continue doing what I'm doing, because I want one person to hear me and know that they're not alone in this world. And it goes back to that positive self-talk. When somebody feeds me a negative, I can give myself 3 positives and keep going.
Yeah. How important is having that support, like your boss?
It means the world. When I was a teacher, I didn't disclose to anybody, and it was really debilitating to me. Going to work and feeling like I'm having a bad day and not being able to talk about it or get an accommodation was difficult for me. It left me very overstimulated and drained and suicidal by the time I get home. But with my last job and this job, I disclosed, and their love and warmth and compassion for me, just because I have a mental illness, doesn't mean I'm not a hard worker, doesn't mean I'm not a good employee. And they see that. They see me for me, and they value me regardless of my diagnosis.
Yeah. And I feel like if there were more bosses and people in general who would have that same attitude and see you as a person, not a diagnosis, then it would be a lot easier for people to share their stories and to be their true selves.
When I didn't disclose my last job, it wasn't until after the lithium toxicity and the cat was out of the bag at that point. And before, I really was like withdrawn. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't socialize. And it was harder for me to do my work. But when I came back and I was shouting from the rooftops, I became a social butterfly and interacted with my coworkers and came to work early, stayed at work late, did more initiatives for the job, and really went headstrong into making this company succeed. And I did that because I felt valued and accepted.
So when you can feel like your true self, be accepted as your true self, you can then thrive. So what I hear is that it's important to surround yourself with people who do accept you instead of trying to convince people who might not to do that, right?
That's exactly right. And me becoming so transparent, I had to let some people fade out of my life a little bit. People who weren't positive with me or understanding or tried to bring me down because of my diagnosis. And that's not always an easy thing to do. Some of those people are family for me, but it's for the betterment of my mental health that I surround myself with people who are positive and love me. I can't hang on to a relationship just because they're blood when they're going to belittle me or not understand me or be negative with me for things that are just frankly out of my control.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the most difficult things. Your family, that's who you have. That's your original support system.
Right.
So it's, if you can figure out a way to distinguish who's good for you and who you can let go, I think that's a great start, because letting go of family, it feels wrong sometimes.
It does feel wrong. And I can't say there aren't days where it doesn't bother me. It's just that we're not a good fit at this period of our lives. Maybe one day we can all have a better understanding with each other. But to protect myself, that relationship had to take a pause. And after I processed and worked on some coping skills around it, I felt a lot better. And my life is a lot less dramatic and harmful today because of that.
Yeah. So what were some of those things that these family members made you feel?
They made me feel like, I think the biggest thing that happened with these family members is they forgot I'm a human being first. When there was a bad moment or I made a mistake or I had a natural human reaction, they were very quick to, oh, it's just your schizoaffective, or, oh, you're crazy, blaming my diagnosis for being a human being. And that's not okay to me today. I might have a diagnosis, but I'm still human. And just like you, and we all make mistakes and we all have bad days, and I don't want my diagnosis to be held over my head or used against me in any kind of way.
Okay, so this wasn't used in a way to benefit you. Oh, give Maddie a break.
Okay. It was the opposite. It was, oh, she's just doing this because she's schizoaffective. Or you need to go, have you taken your meds today? Or you need to call your doctor.
Yeah. Okay. And these are the people that you have to remove, because that's right. The kind of thing, if you hear it enough, you might start to believe it.
And I did for a while. I felt guilty for having an emotion or behaving. Everybody gets angry sometimes. Everybody gets sad sometimes. And I felt a lot of guilt and shame for having a natural human emotion and I got these comments outside of my family. I got them in the workplace. I've gotten them from friends. But I've learned today how to process this. Even my mom did it to me. She's passed now, and she was a great mother. But when she got angry enough, she would say some really harsh things to me. I'm going to commit you. You're crazy and you deserve to be committed. I didn't do anything to anybody, and I'm not a harm to myself or anybody else. And you're mad at me about something else, and you're going to cuss me out and say you're going to commit me over that, knowing I have a deep-seated fear about that. Like, that's not helpful at all.
And when most of these were human experiences.
Like, she was angry at my brother. And when I wouldn't feed into it, her reaction was to get mad at me. Reaction with me when she would get angry was, you're so this, you're so that. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Taking away someone's civil liberties because you're mad at them is never okay.
Absolutely not. And to go through that when you were already in a pretty bad place.
I was not then at all. The comments happen from here and there from time to time from people who may not be educated enough about mental illness. Today, I'm in a much better place when I hear comments like that, where I can process them and take it a step at a time and move forward. But there was definitely periods of my life where It triggered delusion. It triggered paranoia. It triggered a hallucination. It triggered anxiety. And it was just this endless cycle of negative feelings for me.
What are some tools? How do you get through it during these moments of hallucinations and you're having to distinguish what is real? What am I? What do I feel? What are some tools that you use during those moments?
I really like to journal. I like to get it out on paper. And then I'm married and I can sit down with my husband or my therapist or a friend and talk about what happened. Getting it on the paper first helps me organize it because I tend to cycle and cycle if I don't first, the same thing over and over. And once I talk about it, I can check the facts. I can stop and pause and check the facts. Did somebody really say this? Did this really happen? And my husband or my therapist or my friend can help me differentiate these things. But I also think everyday coping skills are important to prevent episodes like that from happening. Getting adequate sleep, sunlight, routine, meditation, exercise, healthy diet, mindfulness, these all come into play of me doing this every single day of every single moment so that I don't have so many of those symptoms.
Yeah, so it doesn't build up.
I find that most of the time when I get triggered, it's from extreme stress or feeling like I've done something wrong and I'm in trouble, which I think comes from that incident when I was 4 years old. But I know this about myself and I'm working in therapy to try to build more coping skills in my toolbox so that I'm not perfect. I'm going to make mistakes. So when I make a mistake, what steps can I take so that I don't fall down that rabbit hole and get triggered? But for the most part, I'm pretty symptom free. So I try really hard to reduce my stress and use those coping skills. I think for me, it's a lot of preventative care at this point.
Preventative care. And like you mentioned, you know that some of this comes from feeling like you've done something wrong in childhood and not really being comforted enough in that. And now you have this new sense of comfort.
Right.
And it,
I feel like I have a lot more self-confidence now and a lot more self-love. I know I'm a great person. Like, I'm here to help people. That's my whole mission in life in general. I'm a kind and empathetic person, but I still have to remind myself of that sometimes. I think we all beat ourselves up every now and again.
And we just can't stay there.
I think that's the key. My husband is good at reminding me of that. If I start to do that cycle of ruminating and getting stuck in the negative, he'll say, okay, we're going to live in the now. I do some box of breathing. I do the stop technique. I do my grounding work. I write in my journal. All the things I've learned along the way. And when I was in my 20s, I knew of a lot of these things, but I wasn't taking them home with me. I was leaving them in the therapy office. I learn a skill. I go home. I implement it. Like, my desk here has coping skills all over the wall. So if I don't feel well, I can look on my wall and say, okay, what skill do I need to use right in this very moment to get through to the next?
I love that. You can see it. You can be it.
I had a therapist when I was in my 20s. I was really struggling. And he said, you need to make a tangible toolbox. Go buy a tackle box. Go buy a toolbox. And every skill I teach you, you need to make an object or get an object to represent that skill. So when you're in crisis, you can literally pick that skill up. And that's why I put them on my wall. I need that vision, that sight, that tangible thing that I can see. Because when I'm in a bad state, it's hard for me to recollect because I'm ruminating so much. But if I have those reminders, then it just triggers that idea for me.
I put an inspirational screensaver on my desktop once, and I didn't realize how powerful that could be.
Right. So my walls in my living room are inspirational quotes, but I don't care because I love it and it keeps me going.
I'm curious, from your understanding, how much of this did doctors and your therapists say stemmed from your childhood experience?
You know, that's hard to say because I didn't disclose this until 2023. The only reason it came out at all is because I was extremely manic. And when I'm manic, I just talk a lot. And I vomited it out one day to my husband. And then I told my therapist. My doctor did say a lot of it was PTSD. But for me to unpack that kind of trauma, I really have to be in the right mindset. And I was battling that lithium toxicity, the brain injury, trying to relearn basic functions. So I wasn't in a safe place. And so now I'm at a point in my life where I can start processing this and understanding how much of what happens to me today is from that. When you trauma, it's very important to feel safe while you do it.
Yeah, and that's a great point. This is so new in this, in coming into that. And that's not an easy topic. Trauma and PTSD related things, we're not sure right now, but we can imagine that some of it did come in certain ways from that because it is a traumatic experience. But I was just curious just to know how much of that have we verified to help other people, because childhood neglect and emotional suppression, it does manifest in adulthood and teenage years. And these are the most important years when you should be able to express yourself and to be comforted, because later in life, it does usually show up.
I sometimes wonder if my symptoms with my schizoaffective would have been as bad if I didn't have this traumatic experience as a child. Nobody in my family has schizo. My dad had bipolar disorder. And so I'm not an expert. I'm not a doctor. I can't exactly say if there's a correlation between schizoaffective and childhood trauma, but I definitely think some of my symptoms may have been lessened if that hadn't happened to me.
Yeah. So you also mentioned a good point is that your dad had a mental illness.
He did. My dad had bipolar disorder. My mom had chronic depression. Both of them had anxiety. My grandparents had anxiety and depression. I don't know if a grandparent had bipolar disorder, but my symptoms for my bipolar aspect of my diagnosis are a lot like my dad. I'm my father's child. When he gets manic and when I get manic, we had a lot of the same symptoms. So I personally believe that part of this is genetic.
Yeah, I would absolutely say that it's genetic. It is known that you are more likely to develop that disorder if you have someone in your family with it.
Right.
You saw this growing up before you understood what was going on with you.
My dad wasn't diagnosed when I was a kid, but I saw the behaviors. And unfortunately, my parents mask a lot of their symptoms with substances. I also learned that at an early age. Like when I stopped sleeping when I was 4 years old, my mom's answer was over-the-counter medication. So I actually developed and have a substance use disorder along with my mental illness. And I was able to get sober in 2009. Having a dual diagnosis is also difficult, having to battle those two demons at the same time.
Yeah, which is another commonality with mental health challenges is that self-medicating property. Because it feels good. It works for a little
bit. I thought it did. I thought if I used substances that my voices would stop or my moods would calm down or I wouldn't feel delusional. But what I wasn't realizing in that very moment is when I woke up, not only did I have a delusion, but now I'm withdrawing from substances and creating two problems for myself.
Creating a problem, trying to fix a problem. If it's in a non-healthy way, it just creates a bigger problem.
Right.
How did it affect your personal relationships?
My mental health?
A combination of the both, or if there was more that you feel was related to one than the other.
When I was using substances, I was just mixed in with the wrong crowd of people. And it led me to make bad choices. Not that I'm not responsible for my own choices, but I was in a crowd of people I had never been around before. But with my mental health, it really made me withdraw from society. I didn't have any friends. I wouldn't be social. When you have delusions and paranoia and voices, it's like living in two worlds. So when somebody responded to me, I had to hear them with my ears and then I had to process it, which triggered a delusion, which triggered paranoia, which triggered so on and so forth. So by the time I could respond, it was either too late or I was too paranoid to say anything. So I didn't say much. And during my early 20s, I was processing all this through anger. I was an angry person. Why do I have this? Why is this happening to me? I don't understand what's happening in my mind. So I'm going to project onto other people. And people didn't want to be my friend at that time because I was an angry person. And I had to retrain my brain to not take out on society what is happening to me and to be a more positive person. And I find that positivity is one of the tools that keeps me in recovery. Yeah.
replacing them.
I didn't want to be an angry person, but I didn't understand at that point in my life how to process what was happening to me. And so I just let it seep out of my pores. And I remember going to the dentist and they were like, oh, here comes Maddie. And I didn't like that, yet I still projected onto them. And I was also using my diagnosis as an excuse. I'm acting this way because at this time it was just bipolar. And I said, I have bipolar. And it was a crutch for me to act any old way I wanted. But today I work so hard to say I have schizoaffective bipolar type, yet I'm still a positive, kind, empathetic person. And I'm trying to show the world that mental illness doesn't make us mean. It doesn't make us violent. We're not going to harm you. We're still people too. And I have to work that much harder to prove that.
Yeah. And it's beautiful to be able to say, I have this, but I am not this. Yeah.
I think people hear the word schizo or schizophrenia and they're afraid. It's a very taboo word. Oh, are you going to hurt me? Or she's just crazy. All the stigmatizing words that come along with schizophrenia. But I've met so many people living with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, and they're the nicest people on the planet. They would never harm anyone. They just want to work or go to school, function in society, just like you and me.
Yeah, because the label, that's when things get tricky.
It's hard to truly understand unless you walk the path. Whether you know someone with mental illness, your provider working with people with mental illness, I just encourage you to listen empathetically. People, it's very hard to get these things out of our mouths. It's very difficult to process these things sometimes. So if someone's coming to you and sharing, hey, have this and this is how I feel, meet them with kindness, because that's a very brave and difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Why do you think people are so scared to let that kind of stuff in?
I think it's because of the taboo and negative culture that comes along with some of these mental health words. See in the media about violence and people assume that they're mentally ill, or in movies, people with schizophrenia are shooting a place up, or it's just portrayed very wrong in the media. And I think it comes back on the people who actually live with these disorders. We're not introducing the idea that, yes, this person has schizophrenia, but look at all the things they're doing in the movies or in the media. We're not praising the people living with mental illness and praising their accomplishments. It's only there when it's a negative view of what people living with mental illness really is.
I'm curious about your group, your nonprofit, because you have to retrain and relearn and be okay and tell yourself that it's not your fault.
We have three groups. Our initial group was for anyone living with schizophrenia, schizo disorder, or bipolar disorder. The idea of it is to create a community of like-minded people where you can heal together. A lot of people don't have that safe place to disclose or that safe place to talk. And I wanted to build that for people like me. We still have it. Anyone is welcome. It's virtual. We have people all across the country who join, and it's just a beautiful place of healing. We give the floor to our group members to share whatever experiences they feel comfortable sharing. And then if time is left, we go over a skill that one of us has learned and share it with one another to promote healing for all. When that was successful, I said, why can't I do this in person too? So now I have two mental health umbrella in-person groups in two different towns where we meet once a week, do the same thing, not just for the serious mental illness, but for any mental illness in general. I found that I had a lot of family members who were affected by mental illness who needed that safe place. So they're invited to our groups as well. We don't shy anyone away. And I'm a big proponent that mental health care needs to be equitable, affordable, and accessible. My groups are 100% free. We don't turn a single person away and we don't charge a single dollar because mental health care is expensive enough.
That's also another barrier, and you're removing that.
Mental health care is very expensive. Sometimes I have a hard time understanding why I have so many added expenses for the way I was born. Not having insurance is not an option for people like me. I have to pay for medications. I have to pay for therapy, and it's very expensive. With my change in job temporarily, I had to get out-of-pocket insurance, and I pay for the most expensive plan because they would give me my medication. They would pay for it. I went to pick it up the first month, and not only was it denied, and I had to jump through barriers, when I got it approved, they wanted, with insurance, $1,500 a month for one medication for 1 month.
Wow.
I don't have $1,500 for a medication, They wanted me to go on meds that I have tried in the past that don't work for me because they're cheaper. It just so happens that I need these new school drugs to survive. So I ended up getting coupon codes to reduce the cost, and it boggled my mind that I need a coupon code for a life-saving medication. There's a huge cost to it as well.
When you add in things like that, things start to stack up, and it's not just about the mental illness anymore. It's about everything that you're working through along with that illness, like those social barriers.
It's very stressful. When my medication was denied, I had a panic attack and delusions started, and I was ruminating about how I was going to go off the wheels and how can this happen to me? And it was hard initially for me to calm down and live in the moment and make a plan of action because I was so overwhelmed. I've tried so many medications in my life, and this is a game changer for me. It's a requirement for me. And the fact that I have to jump through so many hoops just to be able to function. I go to school, I work 2 jobs, I pay my taxes, I don't break the law. Why is the medication that enables me to do that so out of reach for me?
What message does that send?
It makes me feel like sometimes society, not everybody, but like when it comes to things like that, wants me to fail so they can prove something. Like, oh, we told you couldn't do it. I didn't ask for any of this. Mental illness is not a choice. So I'm trying to be a productive member of society. So just help me a little bit. Help me get there. Help me succeed a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. When you come out on the other end of that, with it seems like everything is against you, it's even more rewarding to know that you can do it.
I can do anything I want. There's 3 things in life I can't do. I can't go into the military. I can't go into politics. And I can't go on Survivor because I need medication. And that's about it. Anything else I want to do in this world, I can do because I'm a great human being. Just because I have a mental health diagnosis really doesn't mean anything at the end of the day. If I was walking down the street, no one would know. When people tell me I can't, when I came home and started, I'm going to make a nonprofit. I'm going to go to grad school. I'm going to work. I'm going to do all these things. Most people in my life, like, you're going to get sick. You can't do any of this. I used it as motivation to prove them wrong. I don't think I have, but maybe 1 or 2 people in my life were like, this is a great idea. A lot of people treat me like I'm made of glass. Even today, if I have a bad day and I express that with certain people, they're like, you're doing too much. You need to slow down. No, I don't need to slow down. This is just a bad day. Please don't treat me like I'm a breakable object.
And that goes back to that support.
I try to surround myself with people who believe in me and want to support me, but I understand at first where it came from. Here I am almost dying, learning how to read, write, and swallow. And all of a sudden I'm going 100 miles a minute saying, I'm going to do all these things. It was shocking. Like, they didn't think I was going to survive. I did all this 3 and 4 months after coming home. I recovered at an exponential rate. So I think it was shocking at that point, but this is a couple years later now. So I don't really think there's an excuse anymore to be saying, oh, you're just going to get sick.
What do you mean by get sick?
They assume that I'm going to have crisis. So maybe I'm going to get manic or severely depressed or severe psychosis or debilitating symptoms where I'm not going to function. Because if we're real here, there was periods I worked, but my symptoms were so severe. When I came home, I wasn't functioning very well. And they're afraid I'm going to get back to that point. And the biggest thing I hear is you're doing too much. Like, I have all these coping skills. Like, I understand myself. Like, the biggest thing I do is give myself adequate time to sleep because I know that's my biggest trigger. I put measures into place in my day-to-day life as a safety net, as preventative care. And I would just like that to be respected a little bit more.
For people to believe in you more.
Yeah. It's a little disheartening when you talk to somebody because you're having a bad day or a bad moment, and they go to the worst. They go to the extreme automatically. Be kind, give grace, listen empathetically, and ask how you can support them without judging them or projecting your fears onto them.
Projecting those fears. Maybe they don't feel that they'd be able to do it.
I think that's a lot of it. Some of it is fear from where I used to be. I get it a lot. I work 80 to 90 to 100 hours a week, and most people can't do that. And it just so happens that I'm also doing it with mental illness, and it seems a little bit unattainable to some people. So the minute I have a symptom, no matter how big or small, they jump to, you're doing too much. That's what I always hear. You're doing too much. Where's your self-care? When are you going to slow down? My work, in a lot of ways, is my self-care. I'm a peer support specialist. I get to help people in their recovery every single day, and that keeps me healthy.
Yeah, and I can see that, but some people might be thinking on the lines of when you are constantly moving and you can't really sit down, you don't want that moment of silence. It's because you don't really want to sit and feel and experience those down human moments.
I can't lie. That used to be the reason I worked so much. The stillness was difficult for me, but that's something I work on in therapy. When I'm in the stillness and I'm having an uncomfortable moment, I get out my painting or I get out my coloring and I do something with my hands to help me process that moment. Maybe I journal, maybe I talk to my husband. So I think I am able to live in the stillness better today, but I do think it will be a lifelong journey for me. That's just who I am.
Yeah. Being still sometimes can look like just giving yourself a moment to do something you enjoy.
Yeah. Like today earlier, I had 20 minutes. So I got my painting out and started painting. I did something for myself, and maybe it's just listening to my favorite song or having a nice cup of tea. I enjoy that as well. Anything I can do for myself.
Yeah.
That's self-care.
It's self-care, and it works because there's balance. And maybe it's difficult for some people to see that because the first thing they do is go to the negative. They're not seeing the great things and the great work that you're doing for yourself every single day.
I agree. I think a lot of people's natural reaction is to go to the negative. Me being so positive, sometimes it's hard for me to be around that negativity. So when someone goes there with me, maybe I'll distance myself from them for a little while and create that firm boundary. Because at this point in my life, I need people who are going to lift me up and support me. And if your goal is to bring me down in any kind of way, then maybe we need to take a little pause. There's nothing wrong with that. I can love you from afar while I build myself up.
Your husband knew about your diagnosis before you guys married.
When I met him, he learned that I had bipolar disorder because it's all I knew at the time. And we were married when I found out about the schizoaffective. He did not know anything about mental health when I met him. My mom was alive at the time and my biggest threat, like when it came to managing my diagnosis. But when she passed away, I told him, I said, you're going to have to educate yourself and listen to me because now you're my biggest support team. You're my safety net. But I was really independent at the time. But when I became really suicidal in 2021, he educated himself. He found facilities. He found coping tools. Like he bought me a weighted blanket and a sunlight therapy lamp. Like he was really going above and beyond to learn what kind of needs I need. And then when I had lithium toxicity, he was my 24/7 caretaker. He was doing everything from managing my medication to changing my diapers. And he was really thrown into this caretaking role, which was stressful for him. That's not easy in your young 30s to suddenly be taking care of your wife time unexpectedly. And it did create a lot of issues in the household for a little while. But I think today we communicate. When I have a symptom, I tell him. When I need something from him, I use my I need. I feel manic. I need you to do this for me, please. And he meets me where I need him to meet me. I used to think that nobody could love me because I had mental illness, but now I have one of the best partnerships I've ever heard of. He's my best friend. I love him, but it really took open communication, kindness, and education to get there.
And you thought that this could not happen for you, but it can. Definitely. It just has to be the right person. And it starts with your honesty, your openness about it.
I had to tell him, I'm not saying go on a first date and say I have whatever, but early on, frame it in a way that's understandable, but educate your partner early. It's a key part of your life. And I think honesty is very important when it comes to this. I know sometimes we're afraid to introduce this to a partner, but it is important because you don't want to invest into somebody who's not going to be willing to invest in you and meet you where you need to be in the hard moments.
In the hard moments, which we will all have.
Right. No. I told my husband, I'll be honest. And he did find out in a roundabout way. He saw one of my self-harming scars and asked me what that was. And I told him, and he told me to never do it again. And we sat down and had a long conversation. I live with bipolar disorder. I have self-harming tendencies, and this is what it looks like. And he was kind about it. He didn't tell me, oh, you're crazy. He was like, how can we work through this together so that this never happens to you again? And I knew he was a good one when he said that.
That's beautiful. And it's inspiring to a lot of people. Be yourself. The right person will let you.
I think it's important. We've been together 10 years and he values me for me, no matter what symptom I'm having. And he views me as equal, no matter the diagnosis. And he wants me to be okay. And when I have hard moments, I can truly lean on him. It wasn't always that way in the beginning because he wasn't as educated about what I needed. And I wasn't communicating to the level I needed to. I was hiding everything inside until I was in crisis. But today it's a beautiful thing. And if you live with mental illness, just know love is possible.
I love that. And I received that. So we are getting close to the end here. And we talked about some great topics, your journey, how you transitioned from self-doubt, being stuck, not feeling accepted, to feeling completely comfortable with your truth, sharing it with others and inspiring others to do the same, and to surround themselves with people who understand and support them and want the best for them. Very good. And we also talked about some of the difficulties out there with maintaining good mental health throughout all of the barriers that might be placed in front of you. What sounds like to me is just about continuing to find what works for you, believing you can achieve that, and working towards that every single day.
I would agree with that. We're all unique. The symptoms and coping skills and all the things that I talk about for myself are not going to be the same for the next person. But it's about continuing to try. Did you have a bad day today? Did you have a bad moment today? What can I do in the next moment to make that a little better? What coping skill can I try? Who can I reach out to? And when you have a small win, even if it's just taking a breath, please celebrate that, because that's a huge accomplishment.
Maddie, it's been a pleasure talking with you today.
It's been a pleasure to have me on. It's platforms like this who lift voices like mine that are making a really important impact in the advocacy world. So I thank you for doing it.
No problem at all.
Kindness is free. Let's go out there and be kind. We don't know what anyone is going through in their own minds. So just be kind.
Thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening.